You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with poet and prose writer Barbara Henning. Born in Detroit, Michigan in 1948, Barbara Henning has lived in New York City since 1983, except for a year in Mysore, India, and a few years in Tucson. Along with A Swift Passage, she has published three novels, seven collections of poetry, and several limited art poetry pamphlets. In the 1990s, Barbara edited Long News in the Short Century, a journal of writing and art. As a longtime yoga practitioner, she brings this knowledge and discipline to her writing and her teaching at Naropa University, Writers.com, and Long Island University in Brooklyn, where she is a professor emerita. In A Swift Passage, Barbara Henning celebrates the ongoing life force and transformation as we seek freedom, clarity, confusion and confinement, and everything in between. The pace of life moves us so quickly and with such an urgency to get somewhere in particular, and then we circle around and return to where we started, but it's never exactly the same. Henning's stories and poems blur the lines between fiction and autobiography, prose and poetry. The narrator and her characters try to tell the truth and then examine how that truth then tells them. Ultimately, narrator and characters question whether what's told is the truth. There are stories and poems about moments of sunlight and violence, biking in the desert, war, child abuse, the BP oil disaster, water pollution, New York City streets, unhealthcare in the USA, Tompkins Square Park, writers, driving, Halliburton, government contracts, yoga, divorce, flowers, moving shadows, smuggling, picking raspberries in the wilderness. These works are maximalist in that they intersect with Henning's daily life in New York City and on the road driving across country. Our conscious minds hold memory and experience, the private and the public, and endless variations. These poems and stories intersect with these variations. When I spoke with Barbara Henning in December, I began by asking her how her new book, A Swift Passage, which is incidentally published by Quail Press, I asked her how the book started for her. Had she set out to write a collection, or were these all individual pieces that she later decided to publish as a book?
No, I didn't plan the book as one project. Instead, it's a series of, I think, four or five projects that when I finished them, I felt it was time to collect them in a book. And then I worked on the collection to make it work.
Okay. All right. Great. You approach your creative work using something that you refer to in the book as sequential quilting. So I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about that and how you came to experiment with it.
I started calling it that after the fact, but usually I collect material in my journals, and when I finish a journal, I start pulling out of the journal the material that I think is worthy and trying to find out what I'm going to end up with. I oftentimes will have a series of small narratives or poems that then I do experiments on, and they happen sequentially in terms of my journal writing, and then I do a different experiment that takes, these projects, taking words from one and weaving them into the next one and doing other kinds of patterning with words with it. That's how most of the pieces, many of the pieces, not all of them in this collection took place.
Now, you talk about cracking apart narratives and splicing things in. You also play with italics and word spacing on the page, you know, with the actual look of the piece. And you talk about weaving space and time into the work, and I assume that sort of has to do with this look of the piece on the page. So can you talk a little bit about that?
The look on the page, but also if I'm reading it, there's a silence that comes. One of the things you just mentioned were something I call floating words that I like to interrupt a narrative. A narrative's going, say I wrote in my journal a narrative, what I like to do is to re-examine things that I've written and thought, my own thought and consciousness as part of the process of writing. And, you know, so I have various ways of doing it. And this way was taking, I can't remember which one exactly we're talking about because there's some different processes there. But having suddenly a poem can break, a prose poem or a narrative can break into a poetic moment that sort of fits syntactically with the narrative that I'm writing.
Right.
But disrupts it a tiny bit and then comes back and picks up again. For me, while I'm writing it, it helps me see what I'm writing and saying differently.
Okay.
Often I think a narrative will write you. Do you know what? It's like it has its own logic, and I want to examine that and break it apart and see if there's something else being said there.
Okay.
I think it gives it a layering effect. It's a layering process.
Well, this might be a good time to ask you to read one of the pieces so that we have a sense of that as you read it out loud. If there's one in particular that you think is really good, a lot of them do that. So
I could read Bayport, Long Island.
Sure.
This is in the middle of the time when we had the oil spill, the oil disaster, I should say.
Yeah.
And my grandson was born then. So Bayport, Long Island, a shock of black hair. Little cleft chin, round face, little feet like a fish. Pelican, pelican, pelican. 2 weeks later, he is more than one-third large. One day, he'll be over 6 feet. With a 10-foot wingspan and a layer of webbed fibers, throat pouches full of water, fish, oceanic ripple, spill, sentient, brim over, full over. The terns are fragile little birds. One dive into the oily water, and they don't resurface. I take the baby into the kitchen, and then the red glow of the night light. We sway that baby sway. Pelicaniformis, ancient symbol of spill out, spill over. Later, I come down the stairs for a glass of water. In the dark, the TV is on with no sound, and Greg is stretched out in his chair. His big linebacker body and the infant curled up in his armpit, both sound asleep. Half a mile south, the Atlantic laps against the shore.
That was a perfect one to read. Thank you. That was great. I have questions later that totally reflect back on this poem as well. One of the poems I was going to ask you to read also has to do with your grandson and the pelican image and the oil spill. How did you come up with the pelican image? Was that because of his hair? Was that how that first occurred to you?
Well, I think I was splicing in, I was collecting words from news reports, and then I was splicing them into the poems. I had some pattern that I was using. I think actually, and then I think I took, like, I was thinking so much about water also, and this poem, and I took the words from one poem in the shape of a W and worked them into the other poem.
Yeah, now the shape of the W, you talk about that in your notes too. So how did you come up with the W?
It's probably just a quick decision based on water.
Mm-hmm.
It was just an experiment.
Yeah. Okay, great. Barbara, in your own mind, do you see some of these as being poems and some of them as being flash fiction, or do you not think those labels are terribly important? I was wondering, when people use these words to describe something, how different can we look at these things?
I think it's hard to tell. I think I write right at the borderline between those. And one of them, a flash fiction would be something that would be more narrative-oriented or character-oriented. This is how I talk about it. And a prose poem would have a little more attention to the surface and the style and the form.
Mm-hmm.
Like this one here, this is a poem, I think, clearly to me is a poem, but it definitely has a narrative in it.
Right, right. Well, there's Greg and then the baby in his armpit, and clearly you're talking about the baby earlier. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's both. I see that border as you're talking about it.
Right, and I was, you know, I had been just so moved by the photographs of these pelicans that were just covered with oil, and it was just so moving what was happening to all of these animals in the Gulf during that spill. So,
Well, while we're talking about this, you have another one a few pages later, Deep Water Horizon, and it actually talks about what they go through physically, which, you know, for all that I've read about these oil spills, and they talk about people trying to clean up these birds and other animals, and I don't think I've ever heard anybody go into detail about what they are physically going through, and this was very moving to me, and I wonder if you would mind reading that one.
Sure. Deep Water Horizon. Unable to fly, float, escape, or find food, irritation, vomiting, diarrhea, oil aspiration, ulceration, skin death, confusion, vertigo, tremors, seizures, cardiac arrest, hemolytic anemia, liver and kidney damage, sudden death, chemical pneumonitis, choking, coughing, gagging, swelling, bronchospasms, bleeding, fever. For long-haired animals and birds, it is worse. The chemical dispersants break the oil into tiny droplets, causing irritation, inflammation, headaches, genetic damage and mutations, difficulty breathing, vomiting, kidney and liver damage. Baby turtles leave their sandy nests and head straight for the sea, knowing everything a turtle needs to know. Waving back and forth, spread out, spill over, brim over. The largest fish on earth are 4 miles from the leaking wellhead, from Belize to Honduras to Alabama. They filter plankton and tiny fish from the water through sieve-like mechanisms in their mouths, each animal particular, like a fingerprint. When the whale shark dies, it disappears, sinking to the bottom of the sea. Plastic, lifting, too much, too little wavering back and forth. When one animal is extinct, another proliferates. Biodiversity, the bristle worm is churning up the bacteria on the seafloor. The fishermen will die or relocate. And beach houses in Texas keep tar sandals as regular guest items. The oil, just a nuisance. After all, BP has been good to them, pouring money into their economy. And so they vote yes, yes, yes.
Thank you. I just noticed now something I didn't notice when I read it myself. Hearing it out loud, you hear so much more. And I don't know if this was on purpose, but the 1, 2, 3, let's see, unable to fly, float. So the sixth syllable at the beginning is float, and the fourth from the last syllable at the end is vote. You know, and it's like this congruousness between the beginning and the end and the different things that we're supposed to think about, and they kind of rhyme.
I didn't notice that, but I find a lot of times writing that things like that happen. You do them, but it's intuitive a process after writing for so many years, and you know, many things happen without trying, which is really wonderful. Part of writing.
And it is fun to discover, you know, whether or not they were on purpose. It's so much fun to discover. Now, in this poem, there were a couple of different places where you go into the italics. One is the line about the baby turtles leaving their sandy nests. The other is, they filter plankton and tiny fish, that line. So are those taken from some other source?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly which source, but they were direct quotations from something I was reading,
okay,
rather than collecting words. I actually think I was reading a lot of National Geographics at the time, and they might have come out of those National Geographics, and I was doing some research there when I was I was up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan working on this project.
Now, the project as a whole is worked in 5 sections, and they are 12 green rooms, a swift passage, a slow curve, 14 by 14 by 14, and then the dinner, a novella. Can you talk a little bit about these 5 sections and how you decided to use this structure?
12 green rooms, we already talked about that.
Yeah.
That's what these last few poems came from. A swift passage. At the core of the swift passage is a story about a woman who, an older woman who helps a young Afghanistan woman get across the border into Canada so she can be safe with her child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I started thinking about that. I had all my material together, and I started thinking about that in migration And so I did research, and I went back to Charles Olson and other people, which I describe in there. I don't know exactly why I put them in the order they were in. Mm-hmm. And and that sequence, a swift passage, also kind of follows a journey I was on at the time. So I was journeying across the country, and I'm writing about that at the same time. Or I think I was journeying to Michigan and back to New York City. A slow curve. For a while in my life, I was doing a lot of traveling, and that shows up in all of these pieces here. A slow curve. I had been teaching at Naropa and reading some prose by Bobby Louise Hawkins, who's this great fiction writer, and some wonderful poems too. And I got taken with one of her pieces, so I tried to interview her. I've done a lot of interviews of other poets and writers. And she became sick, and so we ended up talking later on over the telephone like this, I think on Skype. And I ended up talking to her. She's very aged, older, and I ended up talking to her about all of her works and did a series of interviews and helped her by editing a collection of her writing. But at the same time, I hadn't done anything with this one work that initially started the whole thing. So I went to that as a tribute to her and pulled out passages from her writing and worked it into a story that was going on in this project here. And anyhow, so that's that one. And then, so those three were kind of similar, and that's why I put them in the beginning. Mm-hmm. With the kind of floating words and these kind of projects of splicing and collaging and other works and such. 14 by 14 was a series of line poems, sonnets, that I wrote with a poet, Martine Bellin. We had this idea together, and we wrote 14 lines a day for 14 days on little note cards and then shaped them into poems. And then the last one was a fictional novella that I wrote, taking words and phrases from other people's books. So I don't know. It seemed like I was starting with the prose poems, and then just the forms were changing. The genre changed. So I did them in the way I thought the reader would bring the reader into the book.
Well, each section has its own sense, and so as a reader, you do kind of settle into each section slightly differently, each one, and some of them much more different than others, but I loved the way that you had structured it. Now, the pieces mix fiction and autobiography, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that mix and how that works for you and how that ultimately serves the story that you're trying to tell in each case.
Well, the first three at the core are autobiographical or through observation. Mm-hmm. But I would always say that they're kind of fiction because I reserve the right to make the piece work for what the truth of what I'm trying to reveal is. And if that means adding fictional elements to it, I will. And 14 by 14 is very autobiographical. It's just, I mean, you could say that I might write something fictional, but it's a line that came to me in that hour when it was time to write a line, right?
Right.
So where it is, if I'm on the subway, you got a line from the subway, wherever, but it could be an imaginary thing, which I think is all autobiographical. I have a hard time separating it. Even though the dinner, I went more into my imagination, not starting with my own material, but starting with the material of others and then weaving a story. It was great fun writing that novel.
Yeah.
You know, it was just inventing a character and then just going on. I mean, I've written two other full novels, but this one was the most fun, I think.
This was really fun. Now, did this appear anywhere else or did it just appear within this collection?
Actually, it's online. It was published by Talisman, and the last printed version, this is a magazine that's been around for a long time, and then I put it up on online so people can find that the dinner by me online if they would like to read it without buying the collection.
Well, they should buy the collection though.
Yes.
I wonder if I could ask you to read the piece called Barrett Avenue. It's actually going to feel a little bit like a companion to one you already read because we're coming back to your grandson. But this was the one I had recognized when you read that first one. Barrett Avenue's on page 9.
Right. This is part of 12 Green Rooms also, yes. Barrett Avenue. Lene sits cross-legged on the sofa nursing the baby. Little Luke starts zipping and unzipping my vest. I put his two little stuffed rabbits inside my vest and zip them in. I'm pregnant, I say. I'm pink. His eyes light up and then unzip. Two babies! He looks at Nay nursing Logan and then back at me. I unzip his PJs and put the babies in there. Luke is pregnant. Where is Luke? I play it on the piano. Full of glee, he's shaking, laughing, and running in circles. Come outside and help me plant these flowers. It's windy. The wind is lifting his curls. He picks the hyacinth up by the stem, breaking off the roots, and then he walks across the yard holding the purple flower. Yesterday, nearly 60 pelican chicks washed onto an island in coastal Louisiana, fragile, wading into oily puddles or smeared by oil from their parents' feathers, floating, too much, too little, down to the ocean. A crown of plastic flowers for British Petroleum. In the park, an old woman holds a string and a bat kite flying high up in the sky. Her daughter says she keeps everything. It was mine when I was a child. Oil is used to make plastic, preservatives, food packaging, hair curlers, telephones, televisions, balloons, ammonia, insect repellent, heart valves, trash bags, body bags, but not paper kites and cotton string. Luke runs out into the center of the field, watching it waver back and forth. Eons, oh sand, oh pressure, oh my sword, oh the tempest, squall, hurricane, oceanic, subaquatic. At dusk, Luke takes me by my hand, and we walk slowly down the street under the big maple trees.
Thank you so much. So we did already talk a little bit about mixing these personal stories with larger political issues, and I just thought this was so moving. I also really loved the way that you brought us into and then out of, again, the BP oil spill. You go through all those things that plastic makes, and then you say, but not paper kites and cotton string, and that brings us back out into the more autobiographical moment with Luke. I did love that. And then right away, though, you kind of go to those words that keep us remembering exactly, you know, what you're talking about.
I do a lot of research sometimes for the poems, so I'm also weaving and collaging that into them. Mm. Yeah, I loved reading this because I love remembering when my grandson was so young like this. So.
Yeah, so sweet at that point. Now, another poem, I wasn't actually going to have you read this one, but another one that really mixes your personal story and a more political theme. And it also, you talk in here about how plastic makes body bags, and then in this other story you write about seeing a neighbor's body in a body bag being removed from your building after he has died of a heart attack, and it turns out he has no health insurance, no health care, and that's why he was reluctant to go to the emergency room. So there we have the story of this person in your building mixed with the story of the health care crisis. So another just really good example of how you've kind of mixed these things.
Thank you.
So one of the stories, so there are two stories, and they're part of the section about the woman, Tamar, who helps another woman and her child cross the border into Canada to escape an abusive husband. And the first one is called Hajira 1, and the second one is Hajira 2. The first one, Hajira 1, has to do with a narrator that I'll just treat it as though it's fiction, a narrator named Barbara and her stepmother Marie. And Barbara recounts the story about her friend who has helped this Afghan woman and her daughter cross into Canada. And as she tells the story to Marie, Marie keeps asking, is this the truth? Are you telling the truth? And I love that because throughout this, there are various points at which you're playing with the interplay of what's true and what's real. And I kind of liked that it got that concrete in that particular piece. So I wondered if you could talk about this play of truth and fiction.
Well, you know, this comes from a story that someone told me, that someone told them, that someone told them. So I invented the fictional narrative around it and filled in the details myself. But it was, I mean, everything in here is about what is true and what is fiction, that you think about that. And maybe, you, like I was saying earlier, that you have to weave in fictional elements that you think are fictional in order to make the truth of the event that you're writing about come about, or for someone to hear what you're telling. You might make a narrative structure in order for a reader to really relate and keep their attention. And but you're weaving this structure, and how much of that is fiction and how much of that isn't. And also, when Marie says this, it's also, you know, the way we listen to television and the narratives that we hear that make us expect one thing to happen and one thing to be true and another not to be true. And in some sense, in the poems, I'm playing around with that idea of trying to break up kind of narratives that we're so used to hearing and see them differently.
That's right. I'm trying to remember. There was television on in that particular story, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, to just talk about these two stories together, I was so interested in how the tone changed from Hajira 1, where Barbara is with her stepmother, to Hajira 2, in which she's meeting with the friend Tamar. And what I really loved was how the point of view character is different in these two pieces, which to me felt very much like the way any of us is different from being with one person and another. So to me, in the first piece, Barbara is somewhat a caretaker to some extent, but also a child. And in the second piece, she's a confidant and she's a listener and she's listening to a story. And her personality is different between the two. And I loved the way that felt right and true to me. So I don't know. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, what was happening was I was trying to tell this story through the story, you know, a story inside a story in the first one. There's a story of the woman with her stepmother and what happens there. Mm-hmm. She's traveling, and then she tells her this other story about these women. And then the next one is more direct. There's no framing around it, so it would be very much different. You're hearing about the same story, but through a dialogue between the character Barbara and Tamar. And so that, you know, that would necessarily be different. The point of view switches without all that framing.
Yeah, absolutely. And yet also, even outside of the frame, the way Barbara is with her stepmother and the way she is with Tamar feels a little bit like her personality shifts a little bit. Like, you know, like we do, you know, I'm going to act differently with one person than I would with another. I don't know. And it came across to me that way as well.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. You're different when you're together with different people.
Absolutely.
But this story is an important story because, you know, it's about, you know, a story to help people understand what women go through in Afghanistan and how hard it was to even get to migrate to the United States and be safe unless you had money behind you.
Right.
And the dangerous things that some people, this woman was 70 years old, and she was climbing down this ravine to help this woman get to Canada where she could be safe.
Yeah, that part of the story was extraordinary, just all that she went through. And it was very very suspenseful, and I know that this is based on a real story. You know, it's very suspenseful. She leaves her parked in a car to go and investigate where they might be able to get through at the border. And you're so worried about whether or not it's going to work out and if everybody's going to be okay. And it, you know, just like with the piece that I told you, you know, it really brought home to me what these birds feel when they're covered in this oil. It's like all of a sudden this piece really brings home what it's like to actually, you know, smuggle someone or be smuggled across a border. It's very, very poignant.
And I know I had a friend of mine, Harriet Mullen, who's very well known, wonderful writer, and she, African-American writer, and she read this story, and she said how much it reminded her of the stories of the slaves escaping to Canada.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about place. You do not just live in one place. You divide your time between, I think, New York and Tucson and then some other places as well. Does the location where you might be as you're working affect your creative process? Like, do you write differently in New York than you might in Tucson?
I think I write differently wherever I am. But I'm mostly in New York again now. I did actually live in Tucson for 4 years, but I was back and forth to New York, and I'm always in Michigan because I have family there. So in the Upper Peninsula and in Detroit where I grew up. Mm-hmm. But definitely I write different wherever I am. If I'm here and I have a partner here and he has a little boy on the weekends and the little boy is here, well, you know, I'm not going to get deep into things, but I'll still keep a journal. But wherever I am, it's a different rhythm. Tucson was very slow and quiet, and the sun is out all the time, and it's a wonderful place. And I had a different relationship to the word, I think. So
yeah. Now, when you are in, let's say, for example, when you're in New York, do you only write about New York because that's what you're immersed in, or might you be prone to write about Tucson while you're in New York?
I might be writing about what's going on here now or what could be happening there too, based on where my attention goes. But when I'm rewriting, I'm in various places, and then those places get layered into the work. You know, I'll finish a journal, and then I'll do an experiment on it, work on it. While I'm doing that, I'm writing in another journal, and I'm working on two projects simultaneously. One, I don't know what it's going to be, and the other, I'm in a different stage. So I'll be somewhere else, and I'll bring in the other place, comes into the process, the mood, the tone, and even events.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if I can ask you to read another one now, Barbara. Would you mind reading, it's on 54, Billie Holiday Sings.
Okay. Billie Holiday Sings. One never knows, does one, when love will come along. Then so suddenly life turns out to be a song. I'm a little out of practice, he says, and then he laughs. That's a joke. Lying on my belly with what feels like 30 needles in my spine. Out the window in the rain, yellow locust leaves are scattered over the gray world of cement and cars. This is enough, with a tendency, gradually carried along in a body, arriving, holding for a moment, and then a swift passage outward and back into a V again.
Thank you for reading that one, too. It's funny because every time I got to a poem where you used the title of a section or the title of the book, I'd say, oh, there's that title. But in fact, they exist in various places. So here it says a swift passage. I'm trying to remember if a swift passage shows up anywhere else. The slow curve is in a couple of your different pieces, I think.
A V again. See, at the very beginning of this sequence, there's a V shape of the pigeons in the sky. And I'm talking, I think that, but I know that's how I started with the V. I don't know if I say it exactly like that. But so in the beginning is pointing to the poems about Tompkins Square and the very beginning on Avenue A.
And that was another reason I wanted to ask about this poem is I love that in this particular poem, Billie Holiday Sings, you never mention birds, but I loved that omission and the use of other language to convey birds and the flight. And it was just, I loved that. I do really appreciate it when a piece is not so obvious and you can kind of let the language lead you to a place or to an image. And I guess that the leaves too, you know, the scattering of leaves implies flight a little bit too.
They blow around.
Yeah, exactly.
Tompkins Square is one of my favorite places in the universe. And I just moved from there to the Upper West Side. But it was, you know, a very special park that I lived across the street from.
Mm. I was going to ask I know that you're a yoga practitioner. How does yoga affect your work, the practice of yoga?
Well, when I first started practicing yoga, I think what I noticed first that changed was just my process of writing. You know, I wasn't writing out of any emotional urgency. I was just doing it as a practice, just like I put my mat down and I do my yoga practice in the morning, I write. I don't do it as methodically at the same time, but it just became more of a practice where I don't have to have something inspiring that I want to say. As a poet or a writer, you are inspired. You don't need, and I've learned this very concretely through practicing yoga. And then, yoga became a tool to help my life, as did writing. You know, that you study, part of yoga, you study yourself. You learn how to bring balance and steadiness into you through asana and meditation. And you also, it's sort of like something that you do, it comes to you in your life. You become more like that. And writing is another tool, another practice to examine what you're thinking and saying and thinking about what you bring into the world, negative thoughts. Or, how do people, I record a lot of things about suffering, but do I leave people with suffering, or do I try to bring the opposite into my writing so that there's a bit of hope?
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, that's all from practicing yoga, I think.
Okay, great. So experimentation seems to be key to your way of working, I think. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but it does seem like you're a little bit more experimental. And I'm wondering if within all of that you have rules of your own that you follow for yourself and what those might be.
Particularly have rules. I have some things, disciplines that I do. Like I try to write, in the last few years, I write a page at night or more. Before I go to bed in my journal. And I for a long time, I've been like trying to recall moments during the day when I had a haiku-like awareness of the people or things in the world. And then I record those. And so writing becomes a way, and that's a meditative practice. You know, writing becomes a way of life. But I change, the experiments change depending on what's going on at the time, what strikes me. Like, I could tell you what my what project I'm working on now.
Sure.
I wrote a page a day for 2012, and I went back to that page and formed them all into poems that are lined. And it's a story. There's a definite story that takes place. And then I started a long project, which I'm only halfway through, of researching that day on taking words from the poems, searching in the archives of the New York Times for that month that poem was written in, and finding other passages with those same words in it. And then taking some of those and weaving them in. It is an amazing process where I've learned so much.
Mm.
It's got this repetition of words that occurs. That is just sort of, some of them are very beautiful, and I'm enjoying it.
Now, do you ever, put in all of the references so that readers follow along with that, or is that just sort of how you work and then it comes out as a pleasure for a reader without necessarily being fully informed about the process?
I like to say a little bit about the process, I think, and like in this one, I will thank the writers from the New York Times. I will acknowledge that I went to them, not individually.
Mm-hmm.
If I take anything out that I, it's all small things that disappear into words by the time they get there. But, I wrote a book called My Autobiography.
Yep.
A friend of mine, Miranda Moffer, is an artist, and she had asked me to start with, could she collect the corner off of all of my books, or I think it was 999 books off of their back cover, and she did an installation with that. And then she wanted me to then write a line for each book, and I tried to do that, and I couldn't, but so I started finding lines with the process, and I ended up writing, I don't remember how many sonnets, 99 sonnets, I think.
Wow.
By that, and it was all of their work, and then Lewis Warsh wanted to publish it from the United Artists, and he said, why don't you do an index? And I had all kept track of where everything came. So I did an entire index of which poets and writers all those lines came from. That was fun, and that's a book. It's a book out there. So I mention them. I don't always say exactly, but I'll have something, some tribute to the writer that I use.
Okay, great. Barbara, can you mention a few writers whose work has influenced you?
Well, as you can tell, I'm influenced by all the writers I'm reading. When I was a child, I grew up reading Dickens and the Brontes, and as a young woman, Virginia Woolf was a favorite. And then at a certain point, as a poet, I was greatly influenced by William Carlos Williams and his writing, his poems and his fictional stories about his patients and his early experimental projects. Mm-hmm. Charles Baxter actually was my teacher, and he introduced me a long, long ago as an undergrad to Williams and to Weldon Keyes.
Now, where was that? Where did you study with Charles Baxter?
At Wayne State University. Charlie was my thesis advisor, and I took three classes with him, undergrad and graduate classes with Charlie. So, yeah, at Wayne State University in Detroit.
Okay.
He then went on to University of Michigan, and now he's at Minnesota.
I was going to ask you to read one more piece, and it's titled "There Was That." It's in the section called "A Slow Curve."
Okay. There was that. A few weeks ago, I went up to Herald Square just after the big snowstorm. Many days with no sunlight. The snow was melting and was covered with sooty black smoke and urine from passing dogs and men. You have to be careful you don't kill yourself on a day like this. Slip off the curb and fall into a big icy puddle in the middle of a crowd of Christmas bargain hunters. That's why I left New York City in 2005, I tell my accountant, Howie. But then I have to remind myself, it's mostly the way I'm seeing, just a reflection of my mind today. These boots are as good as any. But it is what it is, too. Mind and reality interact with each other. 100 miles past El Paso and heading west like the gold miners, like Dorothy and Toto, but with speed, side by side, moving with the wind, miles of open land in every direction, a double-decker train on the right, and mountains far into the distance, the horizon, a slow curve into the sky. Yes, there was that, and there is this, too.
Thank you. I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed that, the that and then the this. And we can take from what we want. It feels like it's very much about place. But I liked that those were sort of left to our imagination to some extent, too. And then that slow curve into the sky.
Yeah, the that can also look back to the New York City and then this expansiveness of the world.
Mm-hmm. And I also liked the mind and reality interact with each other. That, you know, just as it's just a statement that's put out there, and of course they do, but it's nice. I don't know. I like it in the context of this poem right in the middle of everything there.
Yeah, that's an example of, this poem is an example of how, you know, how yoga has affected my way of seeing. You're always studying the way you think rather than reacting to things always, reminding yourself of the presence and of the illusions that you let yourself fall into, this kind of despair. But no, it's just the way I'm seeing right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that's that. It's what I'm seeing right now. And it has a reflection of where I'm at. And then you don't react. You just analyze it, you know?
Yeah. All right, so I have one last question for you, Barbara. And my last question always concerns advice for listeners who are writers. And in your case, I thought I would ask about publishing because your work is not, I wouldn't say conventional, it's political, it's experimental. So what publishing advice might you have for people who recognize their own style in what I've described as yours?
Well, I'll talk as if I'm talking to students who I work with in MFA programs. I think you get involved with other writers is very important and create poetic culture.
Mm-hmm.
Start magazines. Being a poet or a writer isn't just about sending your work off into the world to someone who's going to publish you because they think you're good. I think it's about living a life of a poet fiction writer is a poet. They're more on word, involved with the word. And, you know, I'm all about community and I'm involved across the country with a community of writers that started very small in Detroit and New York, and we start magazines, publish each other, and that goes on, and that goes on. Once you have a reader, your writing changes. It becomes richer, and it's, for some reason, you really have this reader in your mind when you have a real reader.
Mm-hmm.
Make your own experience, publishing experience. Get involved. Write reviews of other people. Help other writers. This is my advice mostly to students. Start your own magazines and websites and reading series. Be involved. Enjoy your life.
It's like you're saying, enrich the writing community that exists out there and create more opportunities for everyone in a way. Is that?
And your writing will grow from it, and people will listen to you, and you will be published. You participate, and then your work is out there, and people are reading you, and eventually your work changes and grows, and people will start asking you for poems and fiction. And I think fiction writers now in this world where there isn't as much money available for publishing, and I think that I advise them to do the same thing poets have done, which is to start their own presses and just get really involved. I had a group at in a flash fiction course at Naropa, and they started a journal called Flash Forward, and wow, all of their careers took off with that. Mm. They publish a hard copy book and online presence. So,
well, that's great advice.
Yes, flash fiction writers, they should look up Flash Forward.
Okay, great. Well, I wanted to just mention the name of your book one more time is A Swift Passage, Stories and Poems by Barbara Henning, and that's published by Quail Press. Thank you so much for speaking with me. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you, Sheila. I've enjoyed being interviewed.
That, again, was a conversation with Barbara Henning. You can learn more about her work at her publisher's website, quail.com, which is spelled Q-U-A-L-E. Write the Book and the Radiator are supported in part by Battery Street Jeans, where vintage and recycled clothing come together through love. Happy days. Located at 7 Marble Avenue, the south end of Burlington. For more information, check out batterystreetjeans.com. And by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. Internet, television, telephone. BurlingtonTelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic network. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Barbara Henning. She told me that she has used this at the start of a new class to help her students ground themselves. The prompt is called From Haiku to Prose. Go for a walk or remember a walk that you took and write down everything that you see. Then write three haiku using words from your notes. Try to make each haiku a sentence. Haiku celebrate the ever-transforming universe by describing two actions in a single moment in time, an epiphany as the writer becomes aware of reality by observing something simple, striking, and absolutely ordinary. Don't worry about syllable count. Instead, for each haiku, write one short line, one longer line, and another short line. The world turns, the seasons change, everything is moving. See if you can get a sense of the season into your haiku and shy away from metaphors, abstract ideas, generalizations, and statements about the writer's feelings. Stick with things in movement. Haiku do not lecture on ideas about truth, goodness, and beauty. They are truth and beauty. Here are two haiku, the first by Bashu and the second by Richard Wright. The peasant's child, husking rice, stops and gazes at the moon. A thin, mangy dog curls up to sleep in the dust of a moonlit road. Now tell the story of your walk and embed those haiku as sentences into your prose. If you consider your life as a journey, every event that takes place is part of that journey, every action a part of another action. Even these momentary observations are small actions. Instead of breaking for the lined poem, let them flow right into the prose as sentences. In this way, you will have a poetic rhythm in your flash fiction or prose poem. You can use this same technique as a regular journal exercise or as a way to begin a story or a poem. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you are interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, send an email. The address is writethebook@gmail.com. The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about taking part is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I am Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.